Hello and welcome to Iris. This is Trevor Brass reading you the Sioux City Journal for Sunday, June 14th, 2020. Let's take a quick look at the weather and see what we have in store for us. Well, for our Siouxland 5-day forecast, we can expect windy with times of clouds and sun. Winds from the pretty 20 to 30 miles per hour, so it'll be pretty breezy today, high of 90 degrees. Tonight it'll be partly cloudy with winds subsiding. Again, winds 12 to 25 miles per hour, low of 71. Monday, it'll be windy and hot with high clouds. I'm not sure what high clouds indicates, but it's their high. High of 94, low of 70. Tuesday, partly sunny, windy and hot, high of 95, low of 74. I think you're kind of getting the theme here. On Wednesday, there'll be strong winds subsiding and some sun, but still really hot at 95 degrees, low of 69. And then on Thursday, it'll be not as hot with a strong thunderstorm. Ooh, that sounds exciting. High of 83, low of 64. Winds 8 to 16 miles per hour, so it'll be pretty cozy these next few days until Thursday. Alrighty, let's turn to the front page of the Sioux City Journal and see what it has in store for us. This front page spread has a picture of several cabins and kind of a rural area, and it's the topic headline is Rethinking Summer Camp. And a headline, Boji Church Camps Sidelined. Subheadline, with COVID-19 concerns, summer camps think outside of the box to stay afloat. From Earl Horlick out of Wahpeton, Iowa. He writes, the Lakeshore Center at Okoboji, or LCO, is spread over 55 acres along the shores of West Lake Okoboji. Known for its beautiful sandy beaches and a canopy of large oak trees, the center, which included a lodge with private-style rooms and baths, and a year-round camp that serves youth, teens, and adults, was purchased by the Sioux City-based Presbytery more than 65 years ago. Since then, campers of all ages have used the rejuvenating waters of West Lake Okoboji to restore their faith while having some summertime fun. While initially hoping that the facilities would host its regular summer camp season for elementary, middle, and high school age kids, the LCO Board of Directors voted unanimously on May 29th to suspend such activities due to concerns over COVID-19. Quote, it was a heartbreaking decision to make, LCO Associate Director Harry Gabe said. Under the current trends, we simply couldn't protect the health of our campers and staff while still providing the high-quality camp experience that generations of families have come to expect from us. All previously registered campers were given full refunds, had their fees forwarded towards next summer's camps, or had it donated as a tax-deductible gift. Which isn't to say that the LCO will sit dormant this summer. Instead, Gabe said the center will still be renting cabins for a few days at a time throughout the season. Quote, it is easier and safer to focus on individual self-isolating groups in cabins than it would be on a bunch of student campers huddled in close quarters. Excuse me, he said. Quote, that's why we're encouraging families to stay a few days, enjoy the lake and sunshine while growing closer to God and themselves. Still, LCO will likely experience some financial hardships due to cancellation of its summer camps. It isn't alone in that respect. Other summer camps in Okoboji as well as around the state of Iowa have needed to make alternative plans to protect campers from the threat of the novel coronavirus. Like LCO, the Okoboji Lutheran Bible Camp in Milford, Iowa, and its Ingram Lake Bible Camp located in nearby Wallingford, Iowa, had to cancel all of its youth camps, family camps, spring Elderversity retreat, Ingram Ice Cream Social, as well as day camps sponsored by individual churches due to COVID-19. Quote, when kids think of summer camps, they think of fun games, arts and crafts, along with plenty of physical activities, Lutheran Bible Camp Registrar Sarah Hutnick explained. In other words, that would be the exact opposite of social distancing. In place of summer camps with set programs, she is encouraging people to plan their own retreat in a picturesque lake setting. Whether it is a retreat for young people, a church council, or even a family reunion, we'll be able to provide a peaceful setting at our Okoboji and Ingram Lake camps, Hutnick said. Well, that sounds nice, but it doesn't sound like camp, does it? That's why Lutheran Bible Camp Program Director Dan Antoine came up with Camp in a Box, which can be pre-ordered for kids ages 5 to 14. Well, we have an all-new CD and DVD with favorite camp songs, a devotional book, and activity bingo challenge, as well as recipe cards for camp snacks and meals, he explained. The kids may not be able to go to a little camp this year, but we can send them camp activities they can do safely at home. Even better, the parents get to become camp counselors. After all, what better is there to bond with your kids than over a plateful of gooey s'mores? Deciding to cancel all summer programming was incredibly difficult, said Brian Johnson, director of the Iowa United Methodist Camp and Retreat Center. Our first core value is to ensure that all campers feel safe, secure, and loved, he said, after canceling camps at Wesley Woods and Lake Okoboji, as well as other United Methodist camps around the state. Ultimately, the safety and security of our campers and guests matters more than anything, Johnson added. While we did not choose a global pandemic, we can choose how we respond to it. To that end, he said, quote, virtual camps remain a possibility and so are, quote, pop-up day camps since they can be set up safely in local communities. There is no playbook when it comes to COVID-19, Johnson said. We'll do what we can for the summer of 2020 and pray for a better summer of 2021. This is a sentiment shared by Lakeshore Center at Okoboji's Harry Gabe. While some may grieve at what we may have lost this summer, I have a more optimistic outlook, he said. We may not have our young campers around, but we'll now have the time to make repairs, paint, and build things we ordinarily wouldn't have time for. See, there's a silver lining after all, Johnson said. So that gets to a fun tradition for many youth and perhaps older people that enjoy camping out in the Lake Okoboji region. All right, back to the front page where it talks about our favorite subject, COVID-19. Headline, COVID-19. Buena Vista County reports 1,563 infections. This is our, I guess, our daily kind of numbers update from Storm Lake, Iowa. The number of confirmed COVID-19 infections in Buena Vista County rose past 1,500 on Saturday. On a per capita basis, the county has by far the worst degree of contagion in Iowa. As of Saturday evening, a total of 1,563 people in the county had been diagnosed with COVID-19, a jump of 88 cases compared to the day before, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data. Six deaths attributable to the virus have been recorded in the county. In terms of total COVID-19 infections, Buena Vista County is the fourth highest in Iowa, behind Polk, Woodbury, and Black Hawk counties. But because its population, about 19,600, is far smaller than the other three counties, the percentage of individuals infected there is higher than any other county in the state. Roughly 7.9% of the county's residents have tested positive for the virus. According to the Iowa Department of Public Health data, 315 of Buena Vista County individuals who have tested positive have since recovered, a proportion far lower than Woodbury, Polk, and Black Hawk counties, where the outbreaks became intense weeks earlier. Crawford County has the second worst outbreak by population percentage, but is less than half of Buena Vista's. In Crawford County, approximately 3.6% of the population is or has been infected. Of Buena Vista County's known infections, at least 591 were workers at Tyson Foods' pork processing plant in Storm Lake. The company disclosed on June 2nd. It's unclear if any more workers there tested positive for the virus after the company's acknowledgement, or how many of the county's infections can be traced back to that plant. A 60-year-old employee of the plant died of the virus during the first week of June. The number of newly diagnosed COVID-19 cases ticked up slightly in Woodbury County on Saturday, though that tally was modest. 16 new positives, according to the Siouxland District Health Department. The county was nearing 3,000 infections on Saturday, but of those, 2,401 are considered recovered. An outbreak of the virus at the Woodbury County Jail grew slightly on Friday, with a total of 11 infections now reported. Law enforcement officials earlier this week announced that 7 inmates had tested positive, along with 2 jail officers. Neighboring Dakota County recorded 6 new infections Saturday. Of the county's 1,738 positive test results, 1,382 are now considered recovered. Neither county recorded new deaths attributable to the virus on Saturday. Other counties in northwest Iowa, southeast South Dakota, and northeast Nebraska reported comparable tallies of new diagnoses. A handful of counties, including Ida and Monona in Iowa, Cedar and Wayne counties in Nebraska, and Union and Yankton counties in South Dakota, recorded no new infections. Across northwest Iowa, 28 COVID-19 patients were in the intensive care unit as of Saturday, with 20 on ventilators, according to data from Region 3 of Iowa's Regional Medical Coordination Centers, or RMCC, which represents northwest Iowa. Statewide, Iowa's COVID-19 tally climbed to 23,717 on Saturday. Of those, 14,342 are considered recovered and 650 have died. In Nebraska, a total of 16,633 people have tested positive for the virus to date, of whom 9,879 are considered recovered while 216 have died, according to data from the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services. South Dakota's Department of Health has recorded a total of 5,833 individuals testing positive, but only 930 of these are considered active infections. 75 people in the state have died of the virus. Alrighty. Let's look quickly at the mini editorial at the front page of the paper, and that will conclude our local stories and local writing. The mini editorial today comes courtesy of Thomas Widner of Sioux City, and Thomas writes, quote, "If you have a few bad apples, do you bulldoze down the whole orchard? Why would one even consider disbanding for the police? Why not consider it for journalists, as there seems to be far more bad journalists than bad police officers?" End quote. Signed, Thomas Widner of Sioux City. I wonder if he means a Sioux City Journal. I don't know. Let's hope that probably don't take it too personally. Alrighty, let's see here. Let us go into the inside section and look for local and regional stories of interest. Let's see here, a lot of nationwide stories, which we can read those, but we try to give you folks our regional news. Let's see here. Doesn't seem to be as much of that in today's paper. I'm not sure what's... Maybe they just didn't have as much local news. Who knows? Alrighty. Let us take a quick look through the paper here. A lot of stuff to go through. Yeah. Okay. Let's actually read some of the opinion section. See if we can find some local voices from the Siouxland area. Let's see, once my page loads here. There we go. Let's see. There we go. Let's see if I find some local. Hope everyone's doing okay. Alrighty. Let's take an opinion from Ike Rayford. He is the president of the Sioux City chapter of the NAACP, that's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and this is from the local chapter of that organization. And Mr. Rayford's letter, editorial, is headlined, "It's Time to Make Changes Together." Mr. Rayford goes on to write, The state of our country is one of pain. Pain due to long-suffering injustice, pain due to scales being removed from eyes of those previously blind to the situation, and pain because it is impossible to ignore, dismiss, or explain the injustice any longer. Pain is not pleasant for anyone, but it can be purposeful. Through pain, we can grow. We can become stronger, but only if we use it for change. The civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s was painful. Painful for the people beaten and killed, for the children who had police escorts to desegregate schools, and painful for those who had their comfort zone of segregation and superiority dismantled. As a country, we grew from that pain. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act were passed. These were great strides for inclusion and justice. However, they didn't create equality. Let me use the very analogy President Lyndon Johnson used in 1965. Quote, imagine a 100-yard dash in which one of the two runners has his legs shackled together. He has progressed 10 yards, while the unshackled runner has gone 50 yards. How do they rectify the situation? Do they merely remove the shackles and allow the race to proceed? Then they could say that, quote, equal opportunity now prevailed. But one of the runners would still be 40 yards ahead of the other. Would it not be the better part of justice to allow the previously shackled runner to make up the 40-yard gap or to start the race all over again? End quote. When asked why does the fight continue, why does inequality remain, the answers are because we, as a country, have failed to see that injustice runs rampant. We have failed to start the race over, or at least acknowledge that it is in an unfair race. The protests that are happening across this country are a demand to start over the race of criminal justice over again. Reset the runners and begin a new race, with equality. Some will say we do have equality. To those, I would ask you to thoughtfully consider the following. Why did four officers respond to a call of a counterfeit $20 bill in Minneapolis? Was it because the accused was a black man? Why are reports of missing or murdered women of color not covered in the media with the same zeal as white women? Why have countless white people called police to report black people doing everyday things? In parentheses, Lola de Cimbiola napping on a couch in her Yale University dorm, D. Erlion Toles returning to his apartment after work, Reggie Fields cutting grass in a white neighborhood, and so many more. We live in a bubble in Siouxland. We have city councils and local law enforcement leaders who have recognized the diversity in their communities. These leaders see people of color, talk with people of color, listen to people of color. This recognition as members of the community is where true equality starts, because that is where the conversation starts. When we can have a conversation about why the only non-white character in our newspaper's comic section is a cat named Garfield, we start to understand that more inclusion means so much more than the ability to attend school or sit anywhere on the bus. It means being represented in even the most mundane things. Those conversations can lead us to truly understand that protests are about more than police brutality. Police brutality is a symptom of the greater problems of our society, and it must be treated, but the disease of systematic injustice and racism must also be attended to. Enough is enough. The NAACP identifies 6 game changers for the 21st century as key areas where we can progress towards justice and equality. Number 1. Public safety and criminal justice. It begins with eliminating racially biased policing strategies such as profiling, addressing disproportionate arrest and incarceration rates, and racially biased sentencing. Number 2. Voting rights and political representation. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 sought to make voting available to every adult citizen of this country without regard to race. It challenged literacy testing and intimidation practices. Today's challenges to equal voting rights and political representation are gerrymandering voting districts, restrictive voter identification laws, and voter disenfranchisement of ex-offenders. Parentheses, disproportionately, that impacts people of color. Number 3, health. I've heard said that COVID-19 is an equal opportunity virus, but the statistics tell us otherwise. People of color are impacted disproportionately. More contract the virus, more are hospitalized, and more die when compared to whites. Black people disproportionately treated for high blood pressure, diabetes, and stroke. One of many factors contributing to this is the higher percentage of black people unable to afford health care. Number 4. Education. While we no longer have segregated schools, we do have fewer black children graduating from high school and attending college. We believe every child in America should receive a free, high-quality, equitably funded public pre-K and K-12 education, followed by diverse opportunities for accessible, affordable vocational or university education. Number 5. Economic stability. Despite equal employment opportunity legislation, blacks are more likely to live in poverty, be unemployed, and not own a home. The average net worth of black families is significantly lower than that of whites. Efforts to monitor financial banking practices, hiring, promotion, and compensation practices are all necessary parts of achieving economic stability along with financial education and asset building coalitions. Number 6. Youth engagement. We know that our youth are our future leaders. It is important that we inform youth of the problems affecting African Americans and other racial and ethnic minorities. To stimulate an appreciation of people's colors, contributions to civilization, and to develop an intelligent, effective youth leadership. It is a daunting task to strive for justice and equality. It is a painful process. It must progress. We must endure the pain with purpose, with devotion to let it be for change. We must continue to fight the fight. We must do so together, for when one is weary, another can lead the way. Together, we fight for justice because when we fight, we win. Let's take steps to change. Again, Mr. Ike Rayford is the president of the Sioux City chapter of the NAACP. Alrighty, let's get to some other local voices. These are a little shorter letters to the editor. First one, the letter is titled, Toppling Statues Doesn't Erase History. The letter writer writes, I hear about erasing history by taking down Confederate flags and statues, etc., and wonder to myself if after the war with Germany, if they still honor Hitler. So I went searching for the answer. I found, first, modern-day Germany does not have statues of Hitler or monuments honoring the valor of Nazi soldiers. In fact, it's illegal to display Nazi imagery in Germany. Maybe the statues here would be better placed in a museum to keep the Civil War history where it belongs. Just wondering. Signed, Shirley Stoll of Primgar, Iowa. Next headline, our letter is headlined, Misconduct Violates Police Oaths. And the letter writer writes, When a private citizen misuses violence, the government comes down hard. When the police misuse violence, the government looks the other way. This is exactly backwards. Police officers are vetted and trained in the proper use of force. They need to be held to a higher standard of accountability, not a lower one. They should be reprimanded for mistakes, fired for multiple mistakes, and prosecuted for crimes. Police routinely stand behind their fellow officers. That's often okay, but the police are sworn to protect the community, and covering up crimes of fellow officers violates that oath. Unchecked violence is especially pernicious when fueled by racism, and abuse of police power has been used against people of color vastly more than against white people. It shouldn't be necessary to point out that black lives matter, but it is necessary since many police act as if they don't. Signed, James Eliason of Storm Lake, Iowa. And our final local voice letter writer is letter headline, What's Randy Feenstra Afraid Of? They write, Iowa saw a record turnout in our June 2nd elections. That's because the Secretary of State, that's Paul Pate, made it easy and safe to vote by sending out absentee ballot request forms to every registered voter in Iowa. This was a smart, proactive decision. It prevented voters from spreading the coronavirus by having to wait in line, go through the same doors, and touch the same equipment as their neighbors going through the same polling location. It kept me, my family, and my neighbors safer, and it allowed more people to legally and safely participate in our democracy and choose our elected representatives. It was a win-win. Yet, earlier this week, the Iowa Senate Republicans, including Randy Feenstra, passed a bill to prevent the Secretary of State from mailing absentee ballot request forms without first receiving a request from a voter. Experts know that we will have a second wave of the coronavirus in the fall, along with the rise of the normal cold. Experts know that adding hurdles to the voting process will keep people home and away from the polls. We also know that Randy Feenstra won his primary because of this record turnout. So what is he afraid of? What is he so afraid of now? This bill will either further spread the coronavirus or keep folks home on election day. A lose-lose for our health and democracy. Signed, Kim Mathers of Sioux City. Oh, I guess here's another local voice. This is from Sharice Yanni. Sharice Yanni of Sioux City is owner and managing partner of Guarantee Roofing, Siding, and Insulation Company. She serves on the Siouxland Initiative Executive Committee, the Orpheum Theater Preservation Board, Orpheum Theater Endowment Board, and the Iowa Department of Transportation Commission. So since we're kind of lacking local stories, I guess we'll try to read, you know, from Siouxland Voices. So let's see what she has to write. And the headline to her editorial is, George Washington Carver left a lasting legacy. All right, let me get a little drink here before we read her letter. She writes, growing up, history was not my favorite subject. My eyes probably glazed over from time to time. As I've gotten older, I realize that history is important for many reasons. We all learn from it. For me, I enjoy knowing more about people that invented processes or items that we used or still use today. Sure, the process or product may have evolved, but the basics are still there. When I am home, working around the house, I like having an educational program on because I learn about people, history, inventions, and other things. A few weeks ago, George Washington Carver was highlighted in an educational program, focusing on what he did for agriculture. Also, he was the first African American to receive a master's degree in science in the country, and he received it from the Iowa Agricultural College, which is now Iowa State University. I don't recall learning that in school. Also added to the biography newsletter updated on January 2020, he was the first African-American to have a national monument dedicated to him. Born into slavery and barely able to read did not stop George's thirst for knowledge. After the Civil War, Moses Carver, who prior to the war owned George's family and Carver's wife Susan, kept George and his younger brother Susan. Susan taught them how to read and write. Because they were black, George could not attend school near to where they lived, so he had to move 10 miles from home to go to school. After receiving his high school diploma from Minneapolis, Kansas, he was denied entrance into college. That did not stop his determination to learn. He homesteaded some land, and that began his journey of studying and conducting biological experiments, as well as compelling a geological study. He became known as the young plant doctor. People would tell him that their plant was not doing well. He would take it home and essentially heal the plant from whatever ailed it. Later in life, he became the peanut man. Eventually, he did go to college. He was accepted into Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa, where he studied the arts. He had a passion for learning to draw and paint. Interestingly, his drawings were botanical in nature. He had the good fortune of having a teacher that noticed his love of nature and botany. It was suggested to roll to young Carver that he apply and enroll at Iowa Agricultural College. George was the first African American to attend the college. He was so good he was persuaded by two professors to stay and get his master's degree. His brilliant work during his graduate studies propelled him into his career for the remainder of his life. After graduating from Iowa State, George began teaching and researching. He got the eye of Booker T. Washington, who enticed him to come to Tuskegee Institute to run their agricultural department in 1896. Wow. Under his leadership and the faculty and curriculum he shaped, the Institute gained national recognition. As you probably know, farmers rotate crops to help our soil stay productive. This came from George Washington Carver's research. He recognized the importance of crop rotation and the development of other cash crops for farmers. This work was important in the stabilization of the economy among black farmers. George pioneered the mobile classroom by taking it on the road so he could teach those that could not come to him. He studied peanuts as well as clays, sweet potatoes, and seeds. What caused him to become known as the Peanut Man was his appearance in front of the House Ways and Means Committee. Although the congressmen were not at first enamored with Mr. Carver, they became interested in what he was saying about what he made from peanuts such as milk, dyes, flour, and cheese. Because of that testimony, he became known as the Peanut Man in January of 1921. George caught the attention of President Theodore Roosevelt, who sought his advice on agricultural matters. He became the most famous African-American not only in the United States, but internationally too. He achieved the rare honor for an American. The British made him a member of the British Royal Society of the Arts in 1916. Even Mahatma Gandhi asked his advice concerning agriculture. He put his fame to good use, continuing to teach people about agriculture and botany through writing a syndicated column, as well as speaking around the nation about the importance of agriculture and how to keep the soil nourished, as well as what was achieved at the Tuskegee Institute. George Washington Carver did not care about money or spending time to patent his inventions. What he cared for about was to be of service to his fellow man. Alrighty. That's a definitely interesting look at a biography. And let us now go to obituaries. We're about halfway done. And again, I can't find any local news. Darn it. Okay. Alrighty. The obituaries. I got quite a list to read. So, all right. First one, Robert L. Phelps of Northfield, Minnesota, formerly of Sioux City. Robert Lyle Phelps, 88, longtime Northfielder and St. Olaf College administrator, formerly of Sioux City, died peacefully with his daughters by his side Saturday afternoon, June 6. Services will be held on June 10 at Bethel Lutheran Church in Northfield, Minnesota. Burial was in Oaklawn Cemetery. Condolences may be sent online to northfieldfuneral.com. Born on July 1, 1931 in Sioux City, Bob was the only child of Lyle R. Phelps and Helen Quick Phelps. He grew up there and graduated from Morningside College in 1953. Bob earned his master's degree in journalism at Syracuse University, where he met Thora Anderson, another transplanted Iowan studying college student personnel administration. Bob and Thora returned to the Midwest, Bob as writer and editor at the Sioux City Journal, and Thora to her position on the Dean of Women's Staff at St. Olaf. They were married in December of 1955 and moved to Sioux City, where Bob later taught English at Morningside College. In 1961, Bob, Thora, and their daughters moved to Menominee, Wisconsin, where he taught English and journalism at UW, University of Wisconsin-Stout. They moved to Northfield in 1969, where Bob served for another 25 years on the St. Olaf staff, first as director of the News Bureau and Sports Information Director. During the 1970s and early 1980s, he also served as manager of the St. Olaf Band. In 1983, Bob joined the St. Olaf Development Staff as director of Government and Foundation Relations. Bob was very active in the Northfield community as a member of Rotary, NAG, the Historical Society, and Bethel Lutheran Church. In his retirement years, Bob continued to write professionally and for personal enjoyment, as well as partaking in many traveling adventures with Thora. Next, Darlene Biggerstaff of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, formerly of Ponca, Nebraska. Darlene Biggerstaff, 88, of Sioux Falls, formerly of Ponca, moved from this earthly life to her forever heavenly home on June 6, under the hospice care at Ava's House. Service was held on June 13th, at Heritage Funeral Home in Sioux Falls. Burial took place on June 13th in Darlene's hometown of Ponca. Darlene, the daughter of Lloyd Fackelman and Maud Putnam Fackelman, was born on September 22, 1931 in Ponca. Next, Darla D. Osland, Big Flats, New York, formerly of Sioux City. Darla D. Osland, 66, of Big Flats, formerly of Sioux City, after a long battle with various autoimmune complications connected to contracting SARS in 2012, her final fight was unexpected and swift, ending on Saturday, June 6. A celebration of Darla's life will be held on June 30th with more details to follow. Condolences and words of comfort may be expressed in Darla's book, Memories, at sullivansfuneralhome.com. She was born on April 4th, 1954 in Sioux City, the daughter of Cleo and Donna Kirtle Pottorff, P-O-T-T-O-R-F-F. Alrighty. Next, Martha M. Albrecht of South Sioux City. Martha Marie Albrecht, 90, of South Sioux City, passed away on Wednesday, June 10th, at the Regency Square Care Center. Private funeral services will be Monday at Salem Lutheran Church in Ponca, Nebraska, with the Reverend Patty Meyer officiating. Interment will be in Memorial Park Cemetery, Sioux City. Visitation with the family will be 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, June 14th, at Moore Funeral Home in Ponca. Online condolences may be offered to the family at MeyerBROSChapels.com. Martha was born on June 24, 1929 in Dakota County in rural Jackson, Nebraska, to Carl and Elizabeth Rasmussen Hansen. She received her education in Waterbury, Nebraska, graduating with the class of 1947. Martha married Harold Albrecht on January 7, 1948 in Sioux City. She was a homemaker her entire life, always helping on the family farm where she and Harold raised five children. Martha didn't move off the farm until 2005 when she moved to Ponca and made her final move to the Regency Care Center in 2017. Martha was a 4-H leader for many years, was a member of WELCA, it's Women of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and served on the election boards in Dakota and Dixon counties. One of her greatest joys was her family, especially spoiling her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. There were many memories made sitting on the counter helping her bake cookies. Next, Kurt Moody of Kingsley, Iowa. Kurt Moody, 71, of Kingsley, passed away peacefully on April 15th at his home. Memorial service will be 11 a.m. Saturday, June 20th at Road Funeral Home in Kingsley with military honors. Visitation with family present will be 5 to 7 p.m. Friday and will resume on Saturday from 10 a.m. to service time at the funeral home. Condolences may be directed to the family at roadfh.com, so roadfuneralhome.com. Kurt was born on June 18, 1948 at Miss Murphy's in Kingsley, the son of Florin and Dorothea Moody. He graduated from Kingsley Pearson High School in 1966. He was drafted into the Army at age of 21 and served as a medic with the 101st Airborne in Vietnam from December 1969 to February 1971. He was honorably discharged after having been awarded the Bronze Star, Silver Star, and Army Commendation Medal. Kurt married Patty Kohler on April 12, 1975 at Meadow Star Methodist Church in rural Ouachita, Iowa. They lived in Kingsley in a home they built themselves where they raised their two children, Molly and Justice. They owned and operated Moody Electric with Kurt's parents until 1985. He also worked as a welder at FS Repair for many years before working at Beeliner Service until his retirement. Kurt was the Nash Post American Legion commander numerous times over the past 20 years. He was instrumental in the building of the Avenue of Flags at both cemeteries and has always been there to help organize Memorial Day services. He traveled to Washington, D.C. as a guardian for the 2009 honor flight for World War II veterans. Kurt was a proud member of the Plymouth County Veterans Affairs Commission from 2015 until his death. In 2009, Moody was honored as the Citizen of the Year for his dedication and service to his community. During recent years, he enjoyed collecting and researching the history of guns, as well as going to the shooting range with his friends. He enjoyed many years of early morning coffee at Scotch's and coffee at Lamar's with fellow veterans. Any question you had about boilers, he had the answers. He loved having his grandchildren crawl up on his lap to read books until they were old enough to read then, that they then read to him. Kurt spent a lifetime in service to others. He saved lives in war, helped veterans get the benefits they deserved, and was a mentor for vets who struggled with addictions and legal issues. Those who knew him well will remember the quiver of his lip when speaking of the struggles of others and his time as a medic in Vietnam. As quoted in an interview for him, quote, "God put me here to help people. Leaving was the hardest part." Kurt lived a life of service and will be greatly missed by all who knew him. Next, Donald Edward Edgington of Mapleton, Iowa, 64, died Friday, June 12th. No service at this time. Armstrong Van Holten Funeral Home of Mapleton will arrange. Next, Shirley A. Hames of Elmhurst, Illinois, formerly of Laurel, Nebraska. Shirley Ann Hames, 81, of Elmhurst, formerly of Laurel, passed away on Sunday, June 7th, at the Lexington Healthcare Center in Lombard, Illinois, after a short illness. In keeping with Shirley's wishes, a cremation has taken place. Private memorial service, burial, and celebration of life will be held on August 8th this year in Laurel. Arrangements are under the direction of Elmhurst Community Funeral Home, the Algrim Chapel in Elmhurst. Condolences may be sent online to elmhurstfh.com for a funeral home. Shirley was the daughter of Edward W. and Olive M. Hirschman Castor, born on August 2, 1938 in Crofton, Nebraska. She was raised on a farm in Knox County and graduated from Crofton High School, class of 1957. Shirley was united in marriage to Ralph H. Whithorn on June 21, 1958. They had five children. Shirley married Don Richards in the summer of 1976 in Laurel, and the couple resided in Belden, Nebraska area until Don passed away in December of 1986. Shirley married Ronald B. Hames on October 19, 1991 in Yankton, South Dakota, and the couple resided in Laurel until Ron passed away in 2009. Shirley was a bartender at the Wagon Wheel Steakhouse and was also a certified dietitian at the Hillcrest Care Center for many years in Laurel. Shirley continued to live in Laurel until 2010 when she moved to Elmhurst to be closer to family. Shirley enjoyed music throughout her life. She had a beautiful voice and loved to sing, especially in church, and played the piano and accordion. She always ensured that her five children had access to the musical arts throughout the years. Shirley enjoyed baking, arts and crafts, her many bracelets, and the occasional red beer and chocolate strawberries and champagne. Next, Eugene N. Herbeck, MD, medical doctor, Omaha, formerly of Sioux City. Dr. Eugene N. Jean Herbeck of FCAP 70 of Omaha, formerly of Sioux City, passed away on June 4th, 2020. Celebration of life to be announced. Arrangements by Heffley Hoffman Dwora Cutler West Center Chapel in Omaha. He was born in Nelson, Nebraska on June 10, 1949. He grew up working with his father and brother on his family's small farm in Deweese, Nebraska. A proud Nebraskan, Gina graduated from the University of Nebraska for College of Medicine, medical school, and residency. He was board certified in anatomic and clinical pathology. Gene chose to practice his life's passions, pathology, which was second only to his family and friends. He began work at St. Luke's Hospital in Sioux City, Iowa. He then served as medical director of Methodist Women's Hospital Laboratory and medical director of the Transfusion and Coagulation Services for the Pathology Center at Methodist Hospital in Omaha. Gene was a recognized leader in the field of pathology. His impact was experienced at the national and international levels throughout his deep commitment to advancing the quality of medical laboratory care received by patients. He tirelessly served on the College of American Pathologists committees, commissions, councils, inspector teams, the Board of Governors, and as secretary, treasurer, and ultimately as the CAP president. Gene, with his wife, G-E-A-N, launched the See, Test, and Treat program to provide free breast cancer and cervical cancer screening and follow-up care to uninsured and underserved women in the United States. See, Test, and Treat is made possible through the volunteer services of CAP members, their clinical care colleagues, and the generosity of CAP Foundation donors. Among the awards Gene received are the St. Luke's Regional Medical Center Sioux City Physician Hero Award, the CAP Outstanding Communicator Award, the CAP Foundation Lansky Award, and the CAP Pathologist of the Year Award. In lieu of flowers to honor Gene's life, his family requests that donations be made to the See, Test, and Treat program. And you can search that on Google and find that donation link. Next, Gene, that's J-E-A-N-C, Pharisee of Sioux City, 85, died Monday, April 27th. Service will be June 19th at 10:30 a.m. at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Burial will take place at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be June 18th, 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Mary Jane Heien, of Lamars, Iowa, age 90, died Thursday, June 11th. Service will be June 15th, 11 a.m. at Rex Winkle Funeral Home, Lamars. Burial will be at Rest Haven Memorial Gardens in rural Lamars. Visitation will be June 15th, 10 a.m. at the funeral home. Family requests those attending to please wear a mask and practice social distancing. All right, let's go into the, I got three pages of this. Next, Robert V. Culver of Sioux City. Robert V. Bob Culver, 79, of Sioux City, passed away due to complications with dementia and Parkinson's disease on June 11th at Holy Spirit Retirement Home. Private family services will be held at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Online condolences may be given at meyerbrschapels.com. Bob was born on April 25, 1941 in Sioux City, the son of Victor Leroy Culver and Frances Bell Horton Culver. He attended Sioux City schools and graduated from Central High School in 1959. He entered the Navy and was a radar man on three different ships, the USS Wexford County, the USS Tom Bigby, and the USS Lexington County. After an honorable discharge in August 1963, he met the love of his life, Madonna Marie Koch, on September 19, 1963. They were married on May 27, 1965. To this union were born three sons, Keith, Kelly, and Kevin. Robert attended Morningside College and graduated with a BA degree in teaching. He taught in Lawrence, Iowa for 2 years, Fonda, Iowa for 3 years, and in 1975 moved to Sloan, Iowa, where he taught at Westwood until retiring for the first time. He decided to renew his teaching certificate and taught at Sergeant Bluff, Iowa for 1 year before being offered a job at Meritralia and taught immigrant English for 10 years. He worked at Goodwill Industries until dementia and Parkinson's disease forced Bob to retire once and for all. His great love for Jesus Christ took him to hospitals and almost everywhere to pray for the sick and dying. He loved to play the harmonica, a good card game, and fishing with his boys. Memorials made in Bob's memory may be given to Hospice of Siouxland or Holy Spirit Retirement Home. Next, Ronald S. King of Sioux City. Ronald S. Ron King, 66, of Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, June 9, 2020, peacefully at a local hospital. Services will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Ronald King was born on May 27, 1954. He was a graduate of East High School and worked for Agri-Processing Inc., or AGP, until his retirement. He served AGP for over 40 years. He entered eternal rest on June 9th this year peacefully. Ron entered into holy matrimony on September 9th, 1976 to Luis Rodriguez and had three children, Kathy, Christopher, and Timothy. He was deeply loved by all of them. Ron also had seven grandchildren, Nicholas, Paige, Morgan, Brendan, Katie, Connor, and Brecken, who will all miss him very much. His grandkids loved him to the ends of the earth, and he was the best friend to them all. No matter what anyone needed, he was there for them. Ron was a great provider who would do whatever necessary was ever necessary to take care of his family. Ron was a character, to say the least. Everyone knew him. He has a great memory of Ron, from his sense of humor to his giving nature. Next, Fred D. Wells of Sioux City. Dairy industry pioneer and former Wells president and chief operating officer Fred D. Wells, 93, of Sioux City, passed away peacefully on June 12th, surrounded by his family. Fred was the son of Harry C. Wells and nephew of Fred H. Wells, the original founders of Wells Dairy in 1913. A private service for a close family will occur, with a community celebration of Fred's life taking place on August 15th. More information about the celebration to be provided at a later date. Online condolences may be sent to meyerbrotherschapels.com. Fred D. Wells was born on April 29, 1927 to Harry C. and Frida Levson Wells in Doland, South Dakota. He began working at Wells as a young man after school, loading trucks and working as a relief driver. He graduated from Sioux City East High School in 1945. Fred enlisted in the United States Navy and served in the Pacific Theater, first on a Navy destroyer and then on a troop carrier during World War II. After returning from service, Fred attended Morningside College in Sioux City and began his long career at the family business in 1946. Fred married Barbara Mulford of Kingsley, Iowa on April 1, 1951. They celebrated 53 years together and had three children, daughter Susan and sons Mike and Greg. Over his 55-year career with Wells, Fred served in a variety of roles and was named President and Chief Operating Officer in 1977, holding that position until his retirement in 2001. He served as co-chairman of the Wells Board of Directors from 2001 to 2007. Fred and his cousin, Faye, were at the helm during a time of tremendous growth for Wells and its signature brand, Blue Bunny. During his tenure, the company became the largest family-owned and managed manufacturer of ice cream and dairy products in the United States, achieving product sales and expanding distribution to all 50 U.S. states. Throughout his career, Fred was an active member in the dairy industry. He served as board member for the Milk Industry Foundation from 1992 to 1998. Fred was the first inductee into the Wells Hall of Fame in 2011. Fred was an active and generous member of the community throughout his life. He was a lifetime member of the Sioux City Downtown Rotary and received the prestigious Key Award. Fred served as a board member for Boys and Girls Home and Family Services, as well as Goodwill Industries and / the Wall Street Mission. Fred was an active member of the First United Methodist Church of Sioux City. Family requests that in lieu of flowers, donations be made to the Hospice of Siouxland. Next, Richard J. Raymond of Worthington, Minnesota. Richard James Dick Raymond, 92, of Worthington, passed away on Tuesday, June 9th in Luverne, Minnesota. Memorial service will be held at a later date. Survivors include his children and many others. So, alrighty. Next, Clifford E. Schlichte, S-C-H-L-I-C-H-T-E, of Granville, Iowa. Clifford E. Schlichte, 88, of Granville, passed away on Friday, June 12th, at Sanford Senior Care in Sheldon, Iowa. Service with limited seating will be 10:30 a.m. Tuesday at Frisch Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen, Iowa, with the Reverend Daniel Grieving officiating. Burial will follow in St. Joseph's Cemetery at Granville. Visitation with keeping to social distancing restrictions will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Monday at the funeral home. Condolences may be sent online to fischfh.com. Clinton was born on May 1, 1932 in Granville to Joseph and Cora Penning Schlichte. He was raised in the Granville area and graduated from the country school. He was then a farm laborer until being drafted into the U.S. Army. Clifford served in the Korean War from September 1953 to September 1955. On November 17, 1956, he married Dolores Dolly Hagg at St. Anthony Catholic Church in Hospers, Iowa. Clifford worked as a farmhand for 25 years. He also worked at John Van Iperen Elevator and at the Hospers Packing Plant. He started farming the home place in March 1969 until 2000, when the farm was sold. He bought his own truck and worked for Granstra Trucking. Clifford was a lifetime member of St. Joseph Catholic Church and the Catholic Order of Foresters. Robert Charles Kilberg of South Sioux City. Robert Charles Bob Kilberg, 89, of South Sioux City, passed away Tuesday, June 9th at home. Per his wishes, cremation has taken place and a celebration of life will happen at a later date. Bob was born February 26, 1931 in Sioux City, the son of Charles William and Ruth Marie Anschultz Kilberg. He graduated from Central High School. Bob married Rosie Peterson on February 8, 1949. To this union, three children were born. The couple later divorced. Bob then married Cheryl Wilson Peplish on February 14, 1983. After high school, Bob worked for the post office before starting Bud's Auto Parts with his brother. He also was instrumental in building Raceway Park, Raceway Pub, Lake Village Wheel Estate, and Lake Village Wheel Estate. He and his family also ran a gas station and a car auction barn. Bob loved restoring old cars and was a member of the Strollers Car Club and Good Guys. He built a helicopter, earned his pilot's license, and also built a pontoon boat. He and Cheryl own thoroughbred horses and traveled across the country racing horses. Bob's other favorite pastime was coffee at his favorite restaurant, Horizon Family Restaurant, which actually I think might actually be closing soon. So, and like how this obituary ended, Heaven gained a very talented man. Next, Monica J. Fetterman of Sioux City, 74, died Monday, May 25th. Private family services were held. Nelson Berger Northside Chapel. A public celebration of Monica's life will be June 30th, 1 p.m. at the Riverside Park in Sioux City. Alrighty, well, that kind of concludes our time together. So let's quickly recap the weather. So things will be, you know, fairly warm through Wednesday. We're looking at highs in the 90s for today, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then Thursday is when things won't be quite as hot. We'll have a strong thunderstorm on Thursday, and that'll be a high of 83, low of 64 on that day. But pretty much until then, it's looking at highs in the 90s and lows in the 70s. All right. Well, that wraps up our time today for Sunday, June 14th. This is Trevor Brass reading you the Sioux City Journal for IRIS. Have a good day, everyone.